This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Living with the Monks, What Turning Off My Phone Taught Me About Happiness, Gratitude, and Focus. Written and read by Jesse Itzler.
This book is dedicated to my Grandma Sylvia and Grandma Fanny. Wish we could have one meal together. Author's note. I lived at a monastery and kept a detailed diary of my time there. The experience greatly impacted many areas of my life in a positive way. Some people who read my first book, Living with a Seal, emailed me to say they wanted to do my next adventure with me. I would have loved to, but this was a personal journey. I had to do it alone. Plus, I don't expect anyone to leave their families, their daily lives, and go live with monks. And now you don't have to. I did it for you. Removing yourself from the overstimulated world we live in can be difficult. So you must consider the withdrawal symptoms that may occur. Like any activity involving deep thought and introspection, some of the events in Living with the Monks may cause side effects like calmness, being present, and feeling super alive. And those side effects can become addictive. So all readers should take full responsibility when living a more vibrant life. Some of the events in this book have been recalled from memory, and in some cases may have been compressed to convey the substance of what occurred or was said. Some of the dialogue might not be verbatim, and I tried to keep the time sequence of my events in order. That said, it's possible things occurred either earlier or later in reality than they do in the story. Roger that. Scratch that. Namaste. At the 100 Mile Man. He that is taught only by himself has a fool for a master. Ben Jonson. Part 1. In the beginning. Ding, beep, buzz. Ding. A text alert goes off. I open my eyes, and with a glance, I check to make sure my wife, Sarah, is still sleeping. Check. It's still dark out. And the only illumination in our bedroom is my glowing phone. Carefully, I roll over to my side and reach toward the nightstand to find it. I need 2 tickets to the Hawks game tonight, the text says. I got you, I text back. As I sink back into bed, I pull the covers over my head to eliminate the brightness of my phone. I don't want to wake Sarah. I quickly refresh my email to see what's come in my inbox during the 5 hours I was sleeping. Too many. I swipe it away. I check the time. It's 4:53 a.m. I have to get up because I have a workout appointment in 7 minutes. Seal, the man who kicked my ass and lived with my family for 31 days, is at my house. And the rule is, if Seal is at my home, we're working out. 2 minutes later, I check my email again. Nothing new. I swing my legs off the bed and quietly place both of my feet on the rug. My wife's still sleeping. I slip my phone into the pocket of my shorts and throw on the t-shirt that's balled up on the floor. I tiptoe out of our bedroom into the long hallway. All 4 of my children are fast asleep as I pass each of their bedrooms. When I reach the top of the stairs, I hear another ding. I manage to respond to the text as I walk down the steps and simultaneously fire off 2 emails before getting to the bottom of the stairs. I enter the living room and have one eye on my phone and the other on something Seal is doing. He's fussing with the remote trying to turn the television off. He can't figure out which button to press. He's mad at the remote and looking at it like it's a Rubik's Cube. I fire off 1 more email as he spots me. It's 4:58 a.m., so I'm early. What the fuck is that? Seal asks, staring at my hand. This? Oh, it's a phone. Seal takes 1 more glance at the remote and now decides he's no longer pissed at the controller. He's now pissed at me. I can tell he's getting annoyed. Very annoyed. He's staring at me stone-faced. He's not moving, like, at all. For a second, I think he's playing some whacked-out version of freeze tag in his head. He's as still as a statue. After about 30 seconds of just staring at me, he snaps out of it. It's like he was never still. Oh, it's a phone, he mimics like a 3-year-old teasing his big brother. Oh, it's a phone. He inches closer to me, in my face. I'm not sure why he's so livid. What did I do? It is, in fact, a phone, right?
You don't think I know what a phone is, Jesse? I use phones, motherfucker. I just used one yesterday. I know a phone when I see one.
Oh, it's a phone, he says a third time as he bends down to lace up his running sneakers. I'm very sorry, I say, trying to make peace. I just thought,
I know what a phone is, Jesse.
I try to craft an apology in my head. I'm not sure why, but I feel like I truly owe him one. Sorry, I say again. I just thought you asked me what's in my head.
Jesse, are you committed?
I'm confused. I'm not sure where he's going with this.
Let me save you some time, motherfucker, he says. You're not.
Huh? I'm sorry, comes out of my mouth a third time.
You and that damn phone, he says. You need to clear your mind, Jesse, to be committed.
He's so angry that one can mistake his committed to mean sending me off to a mental institution. But I'm pretty sure he's talking about making a commitment to myself. And maybe he's right. I do need to unplug, but unplugging is only half of a fix. I need to plug into something else, something bigger than myself, a 180, to get uncomfortable again, a self-imposed timeout and find a growth opportunity. Seal helped me get physically fit and sharpen my mental toughness, but now I need something that'll help me quiet my mind and create a new kind of edge. I look back, and Seal is already holding the front door open for me.
Let's go for a run, Seal says.
I'm not sure what happened, but it's like someone flipped the switch and he's fine again, not mad. It's like I never even had a phone. As I follow him out the door, I fight an urge to check my phone one last time. A few days later, I click on a link that a friend sent to me, a picture of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen Buddhist super monk, pops up on my computer screen. The photo is, well, I don't know, likable? But it's not so much how he looks, which is a pleasant face with protruding ears and a balding head, but the way he looks. It appears like he's operating on a higher plane. This is what I'm searching for. I need to figure out how to spend a few weeks in his shadow. I want to live on his monastery. My wife always tells me I'm too impulsive, that I don't think things through before taking action. And it gets me in over my head sometimes, maybe, but I like to go with my gut, and my gut is telling me that he's my guy. I start reading the article. It turns out the holy monk, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce his name, Thich Nhat Hanh, maybe? We'll call him Thich for short, lives on the Plum Village Mindfulness Practice Center in the Dordogne region in the south of France. He's a master of spirituality and mindfulness. He trains people to become fully present, which sounds fantastic, except you have to commit to the place for 5 years, freeze all of your bank accounts, and you're not allowed to see your family during the first 2 years of monkism. I may be able to get over the 5-year commitment, but not seeing my family is a non-starter. Okay, so his isn't a shadow I'll be walking in anytime soon. Although living with Thich might have been a tad aggressive, I'm not ready to give up my spiritual quest. My life is abundant, but sometimes I feel overwhelmed. On top of electronic and social media accessibility 24/7, there are my 4 kids and their schedules, to-do lists, business appointments, charity events, workouts, and running routines. And somehow, amid all of that, I have to find time for my loving relationship with my wife. I shouldn't say I have to, I want to. But above all, I want to learn something new. I start imagining how much I could accomplish if I blocked out all of the noise in my head, prioritized my time, and learned to be truly present in the moment. I need a plan B. I pick up my phone and speed dial my literary agent, Lisa Leshny. Hi, Jesse, Lisa says after one ring. I hear wind whipping against her phone. She's probably walking her dog Luna somewhere in Riverside Park on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. because just as she says hello to me, I hear her tell someone that Luna's a rescue dog. I want to live on a monastery, I say. Okay, she responds, but don't you mean at a monastery? Either way, I just want to go live with monks. Any particular reason why? I did the physical part. I want to explore the spiritual side. I want better focus, stronger mindset. Aren't there podcasts for that? Perhaps, but I need to immerse myself, just like I did with Seal. And that's when the idea hits her. She tells me to hold and then patches me in with the editor from my book, Living with a Seal, Kate Hartson. When Kate answers, Lisa tells her I'm on the call. I hope you're ready for this one. Jesse wants to go live with a monk, Lisa says, or multiple monks. And I believe you know some monks who might fit the bill. There's nothing but silence on the line. Kate must think it's a terrible idea, but my mind is already made up. I want to do this. I'm waiting to hear her reaction, but it doesn't matter what she says. I don't need her to sign a permission slip. I'm locked in. I actually know of a monastery where you can go, Kate finally says. You do? Would they freeze my assets and tell me I can't see my family for 2 years? Excuse me? Are they in the south of France? Well, no. The monastery is in upstate New York. Upstate New York? That sounds perfect. Can I go for a couple of weeks? I'm pretty sure they'd be happy to have you. Okay, book it. 2 weeks or so for some personal development. Some me time. Don't you want to know more about them? Kate asks. Are they monks? Well, yes. That's all I really need to know. If my wife was with me, and she's not, she'd shake her head and say something like, see what I mean about not thinking things through? Okay, Kate says in a tone that sounds like she thinks I'm a little chemically imbalanced, but they're called the Monks of Nooski just in case you get lost. An hour later. I pick up my phone and dial my wife. Sweetie, can we talk for a second? Sure, my love, she says. What's up? I'm going to live in a monastery. I'm hoping it was fast. Fast enough she only half hears me, except my wife doesn't have half hearing. She has whole hearing, and she heard me perfectly clear. A monastery? As in monks? Yes, as in silence, meditation, and monks. I can tell from the long pause that Sarah is processing the information. That's what Sarah does. She's a processor. She thinks things through before making a decision. I, on the other hand, am a reactor. I hear the word challenge and immediately react with, I'm in. And in this case, Sarah taking her time is justified. Some guys need an excuse to go to a bachelor party in South Beach or a hall pass for a weekend in Vegas, but I'm trying to go to a monastery, which is a lot to process. So before she responds, I follow it up with a kicker to help my cause. And it's going to make our marriage even stronger, sweetie. Stronger? Sarah asks. Then she repeats the word again with more curiosity. Stronger? Explain that one to me. Well, I think it'll help me appreciate our time together. Be more present. Stuff like that. Jesse, this sounds like an excuse to go run a marathon somewhere with your friends. No, I'm serious. I'm planning on going next month. Then, love, have you lost your marbles? Because there are plenty of other solutions to make a marriage stronger. Like maybe we should just go for more walks together. She has a point. But this isn't really about making our marriage stronger. I need a different angle. Quick. A few years ago, I realized I was watching an awful lot of football. College games on Saturday and the NFL on Sunday, Monday, and Thursday were on my viewing schedule. It was excessive. And while I did love watching the games, I calculated that if I kept on that pace and lived to be 82 years old, I'd waste another 36,000 hours of my life watching football. Think about that. Watching other people play a sport. It was a wake-up call. So I immediately unplugged the TV and went cold turkey. And right after I made the decision, I told Sarah that I just freed up 36,000 hours of my life to use as I saw fit. That's 1,500 days, 4 years. So then Sarah asked me what I was going to do with all of that newfound free time. Some of those hours are for you, I said with a flirtatious smile. Some are for personal adventures. And right now feels like a good time to pull out the adventure card. It's worth a shot. I'm using some of the 36,000 hours I freed up, sweetie.
Really, darling?
Okay, now don't let Sarah's blonde, bubbly charm fool you. She built Spanx, one of the most popular women's undergarment companies in the world, and she did it entirely on her own, with $5,000 of savings and no investors. So, she can smell when there's something fishy going on.
So it's going to make our marriage better, huh?
Much. You know, sweetie, you are so full of shit, but you're darn cute. If you want to go live in a monastery, then you should go and enjoy yourself, Mr. Monk. Okay, then, it's set. One of my favorite business rules is don't oversell. When you get the order, shut up and leave. So I respond with, I love you, dear, and immediately hang up. The next couple of weeks are business as usual. Sarah is supportive, but leery of my plan or lack of planning. She wishes I do more research and preparing, but when I'm ready to do something, I don't let anything slow me down. Ready, fire, aim. Soon I'm counting days instead of weeks and then hours instead of days. It's almost go time. The night before I'm set to leave for the monastery, I craft a social media blast. It's partly a heads up to tell people I'll be off the grid for a while and also a request for suggestions for a book or two I should bring. Moments after I hit send, my phone starts to sound like a Las Vegas casino. Dings, beeps, and buzzes. It doesn't stop. Along with commenting on favorite books, How to Be a No-Limit Person, Mindful Parenting, Man's Search for Meaning, I get suggestions for blogs on meditation, spiritual guides to follow on Twitter, podcast recommendations, and must-watch documentaries about happiness, mindfulness, and soul-searching. Everyone has a favorite. The comments keep coming in. Ding, beep, buzz. The responses are passionate from people who have found a helpful nugget to make their daily lives a little bit better. They're eager to share. Of my 1,000 career Instagram posts, it's the most commented one of all time. As I look at my phone, I realize I've hit a nerve. The search for living a more meaningful life is a viral topic, and yet, it seems, at least the way my life unfolds on a daily basis, that we don't have time for anything that isn't announced with a ping. And here's the thing. Every day, information, news, and entertainment bombard us. It comes at us from all angles, like we're under attack. We are living in complete information overload. Meanwhile, we're losing, or have lost, our most significant asset. The ability to think for ourselves. At every turn, we're told what to do, where to go, and what to like. Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook make decisions for us. Alexa, Siri, and Google Home tell us how, when, and where for everything else. But we weren't wired this way. It's more of a learned trait. All those pings over time have trained us to read and respond immediately. As soon as an email hits our inbox, we feel the need to respond right back. It's gotten to a point that it controls our time. And yet, I've always been a guy who relies heavily on his gut. Or at least I used to be. When your combined score on the SATs is 900, you either have a good gut or you don't go very far in life. And my instincts have served me well. But as my wife always tells me, the only way to be in tune with your gut is to be alone, thinking. I've found that if you lose your gut feel, you lose one of your greatest secret weapons. In fact, in virtually all areas of life, instinct is critical. When it's firing on all cylinders, the force is always with you. And for me, it's always guided my decisions on friends, work, and life adventures. As I scroll through the thousands of responses to my post, I start to get energized. I know I'm on the right path. The path to the monastery. I'm in big trouble. He will win who prepared himself, waits to take the enemy unprepared. Sun Tzu. November 2017, New York City. 8 months after the monastery. How do you say I'm fucked in a Zen-like way? Well, I better figure it out quick. I'm not ready for my meeting, so I'm rooting for traffic as I zip up 6th Avenue in the back of a cab. If there's enough of it, then I'll be so late they'll have to cancel the appointment. I'm not looking forward to what's about to happen, but unfortunately, every traffic light instantly turns green as we approach it. We keep moving. It's been 8 months since I left the monastery, and today, I'm supposed to deliver a manuscript to my publisher about my monk experience. And I've got nothing. I should say practically nothing. I do have a journal with me, notes I jotted down each night in the tiny room monks call it a cell I lived in for 15 days, but that's it. The taxi pulls over to the side of the street. I pay the cabbie and step onto the Midtown Manhattan sidewalk. A public relations mogul once told me that the key to crisis management is to get all of the bad stuff out in the open and on the table right away. So maybe that's what I should do with my meeting. I should come clean with my editor right out of the gate. I'm screwed, Kate. I have nothing. Oh, and good morning. I'm standing on the corner of 6th Avenue and 54th Street when the light changes. The sea of business people who surround me take off like it's an Olympic sprint. I, on the other hand, am in no hurry to cross the crosswalk to get to Hachette Book Group, my publisher. Perhaps I should leave with a positive and sugarcoat the crisis rule. Good morning, Kate. You look great. Did you get a haircut? Oh, and by the way, I'm screwed. I push the glass revolving doors and enter into the wide open lobby. There are two people in a heated argument over a food delivery in the building foyer. But no one seems to notice them. Instead, they just swipe their cards on the electronic turnstile and rush to an elevator without buttons. Everyone seems so busy. I start to make my way over to the front desk. Jesse, I hear behind me. Jesse, over here. I turn to see Kate. She's smiling and holding two steaming grande Starbucks lattes. I go over and give her a hello hug, careful not to spill the lattes, of course. She was the editor on my first book, which exceeded her expectations, and it's the sole reason she bought the monk book idea. But the window to leave with my bad news is already open and shut. We walk over to the elevator bank. I'll just tell her about the book situation when we sit down in the conference room. The Hachette main desk is on the 4th floor. Kate's office is on the 5th. We walk up a staircase to an open room that's filled with editors quietly editing and assistant editors quietly assisting. The cubicles are full of smart-looking people. There's something very zen about it. Or maybe it's just boring. I follow Kate as we snake our way to a windowless conference room. When Kate slides the door shut, it's like we're hermetically sealed. She turns to face me. "I can't wait to see what you have, Jesse," she says, smiling.
I manufacture a smile and stare back.
Kate's still smiling. She's excited to see the manuscript. It was a little more difficult than I thought, I say in a voice that sounds like I'm 9. Her smile begins to fade. It's like a half smile. And there it goes. It's gone. The monks don't really do much, I say. They're monks after all. Well, surely you have something, she says. Surely, I say. 150 blank pages of me being silent. Now her smile is a distant memory. I wait for her to say something. What happened? There's a certain freedom in being totally screwed. When you're totally screwed, things can't get any more screwed up. And in that moment, totally screwed, I find the confidence that only comes with being screwed. I push back on the rolling chair, get real comfortable. Let me start at the beginning, I say. Like all great spiritual journeys, this one starts on a mountaintop. the visibility from Mount Washington. Everyone wants to live on top of the mountain, but all the happiness and growth occurs while you're climbing it. Andy Rooney. January 2017. I have to start somewhere, and well, this seems like the perfect spot. It was about 2 months before I arrived at Nuskeet, and I wasn't thinking about monks or monasteries, no. I was focused on the challenge in front of me, the mountain. My friend Kevin the Cop had mentioned climbing Mount Washington the previous summer in passing, like someone asking if you wanted to grab lunch next week. Kevin's a police officer in Suffolk County, and at first glance, you'd never guess he's capable of van damming an entire bar full of bad guys. He isn't all that tall, but he's beastly strong and fit. But when you get up real close and look deep into his eyes, you can see the extra screw-loose gene. And yet, Kevin is also one of the most optimistic people I know. He's positive all the time, unless, of course, he's kicking your ass. But even then, he's positively kicking your ass. When he casually threw out the invitation for a new adventure, we were at my house in Connecticut. Every year, I hold a race called Hell on the Hill. It's a steep, grassy incline that you attempt to run up and down 100 times. But sometimes it includes paramedics. It's hard. Someone who's really in shape can do it in 2 hours and 40 minutes. Kevin knocked it out in 1 hour and 42 minutes. He won the race and beat me by close to an hour. I was bent over trying to catch my breath when he threw the offer out. I asked him how high Mount Washington was between breaths. He said 4.5 miles in a way that made it sound like a walk through the mall. Once I caught my breath, I asked him if it was okay to bring some friends along. He said sure. So I invited my trainer, Mark Brown, who played linebacker at Auburn and for the New York Jets. He said yes because he's always down for a challenge. And then I extended invitations to my buddies Adam Hynek, a finance guy, and Nick Morris, who started Health Warrior Energy Bars. And they both immediately said yes. I'd never climbed a mountain before, so I had no idea what we were getting into. And I knew nothing about Mount Washington. So when Mark asked me where it was, I said, Vermont, I think. It turns out the mountain is in New Hampshire. Seeing as it was Kevin's idea, I should have known the climb wasn't going to be easy. The first hint of how hard it might be came a few days before we were supposed to leave. I received a couple of emails from him. The first one included a packing list. Ice axe, crampons, which are shoes with spikes in them, and multiple layers of Arctic clothing. An ice axe? I had none of the equipment, and we were climbing the mountain in 2 days. What the? The second email had one word in the subject line. Survival. The first thought that came to me was, you mean there's a chance I won't? I immediately hit print and put it in my suitcase. I mean, any email with the subject line survival is one that I want to keep. After the second email, I figured I better get a look at what I was getting into. I pulled up the mountain's Wikipedia page on my laptop. How can I explain this? Well, one of the toughest mountains to climb in the United States is Denali in Alaska. And Mount Washington in the winter makes Denali look like a bunny slope. Okay, maybe that's an exaggeration, but the winds at the summit of Mount Washington have been recorded at 265 miles an hour. Mount Washington has one of the highest death rates among climbers of any mountain in the United States. Temperatures can sink to minus 35 on any given day. The climb is a shitstorm of pelting snow and frigid air that blasts you in all four directions. And that's why the mountain earned the title, the world's worst weather. Yeah, I said to myself, a walk through the mall. I headed over to REI with Mark to pick up gear for both of us, as we had nothing. One of the items Kevin strongly suggested was a minus 40 sleeping bag to keep us warm in anything above minus 40 degrees. The plan, he said, was to spend one night sleeping outside on the mountain and then summit the next day. Sleep outside? On the mountain? And with temperatures that get to minus 35, We need a minus 40 sleeping bag to protect us. That doesn't seem like a big margin for error. When I spotted a salesperson in the store, I asked for the minus 40 bags.
We're in Atlanta, the sales guy said.
Right. We don't have a lot of calls for those here.
Do you have two negative 20s, I asked? Or a 10 and two fives?
Are you serious? I was serious. If I could wrap myself in two of them, it might work, right?
We needed something.
I raised my eyebrows a bit to try to get a real response from him. But instead, he delivered one of those pained, try not to be a jerk off kind of smiles that certain salespeople have perfected. We were striking out. Instead, Mark and I purchased the warmest gloves they had and bolted from the store, otherwise empty-handed. At home, I fired up Amazon Prime and ordered the rest of the gear we needed with next-day delivery. And that night, we had a scheduled conference call with the group to go over everything with Kevin. It was kind of like our pregame pep talk. Kevin took us through point-by-point what we could expect from the mountain. His voice was calm, which started worrying me a bit.
What's the greatest risk we face? I asked right after he wrapped up the game plan.
Someone breaks their leg and we have to carry them down the mountain, he said. If that happens, we're real shit fucked. They can't land the helicopter up there.
What?
But it's cool. I'll carry the injured party down and come back for the rest of yous.
I'm not sure if yous is a word or not, but I let it go.
What if yous break your leg, I asked. The rest of us don't know the way down.
The line was silent for a moment.
Good point, Kevin said finally. I'll bring Jack.
Jack, as it turned out, was a survival expert, something every mountain climb should have. After the call, I decided I should try to get a good night's rest, but I could barely sleep. Tossing, turning, and thinking, tossing, and turning. When my morning alarm finally rang, I felt like I only had an hour of sleep. And then at 6 o'clock p.m. the next day, Mark and I landed at Boston's Logan International Airport. The mountain was about 170 miles from Logan, which took us about 4 hours on the snow-glazed roads. Eventually, we pulled into the ice-covered driveway. The house we rented looked precisely how you think a ski chalet should. Wood everything, stone fireplace, and bunk beds. When we were finally inside, some 7 hours after we left Atlanta, I could feel the excitement brewing like an old-school Mr. Coffee machine. Kevin and Jack were already there. With his weathered skin and military gray haircut, Jack looked like a cross between a drill instructor and the Marlboro Man. He even talked with a raspy voice. He was the kind of guy you'd follow into battle, or up a mountain. When I unpacked my boots, they still had the tissue paper in them. I felt like the kid who shows up at hockey camp with brand new equipment and then skates on his ankles. I quickly pulled out the tissue paper and shoved it in my pocket. In the kitchen of the house, we had an impromptu huddle. Kevin went over the particulars of the mountain again for us, the height, visibility or lack thereof, and how long he figured it'd take us to climb, which he said was about an hour for each mile, which meant it should take us close to 5 hours to reach the summit. When I asked what was the most dangerous thing that could happen, I mean, besides breaking a leg, Jack answered.
People have been known to walk off the mountain because they couldn't see the edge, he said, sounding like Quint talking about sharks in the movie Jaws.
You mean they just step off?
The quick way down.
He added that we'd be all right if we stayed close and walked single file with Kevin up front and him in the rear.
People have stepped off the mountain?
It was a visual I didn't need planted in my head. 15 minutes later, I was clomping around on the wood floors with my new boots, and 5 minutes after that, my legs were so tired it was like the boots were made out of cinder blocks. They were also as stiff as ski boots. It felt like they were cutting off my circulation at the ankles when I leaned forward. How the hell was I going to climb a mountain in them? Next, I put on my brand new backpack and clomped up and down the floor. It wasn't going well. If this had been a slasher flick, the audience would have pointed to me and said, "Yup, that dude right there, he's going to die first." Kevin explained that packing your backpack is one of the most important things someone climbing a mountain can do. It's paramount to survival. It can mean life or death when you're up there at 0 degrees with zero visibility. Showing us, Kevin precisely placed all of my items into the pack. Insulation, winter coat, 3 pairs of gloves, water, food, and goggles. All the essentials are up at the top and easy to access. It's kind of like elevator science. First in, last out. Last in, first out. The sleeping bag goes on the bottom, then your heaviest jacket, heaviest layer, lighter jacket, light layer, hat. Goggles and gloves are on top with extra ski hats. Your insulation roller, you need something to put under the sleeping bag when you sleep so you don't freeze as you lose the most heat through the ground, is tied to the bottom of the backpack. 3 bottles of water are put in insulation sleeves that dangle from the side of the pack, and you fill them 3/4 of the way so they freeze slower. Food is in the outside pockets. Then you also have an ice axe attached to your backpack. Fully loaded, the pack weighs 57 pounds. 57 pounds while wearing stiff cinder block boots. No problem. It was the eve of my next big adventure, so I blasted it all over Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram that I was at Mount Washington. They say that one of the best ways to accomplish a goal is to have an accountability partner. What better way to do that than putting it out on social media? Immediately, the responses started coming in. I didn't know you were a climber, I'm a cold weather guy, and you're on top of the world. And with each response, I could feel the pressure rising. The next morning, we got up at 0500. After breakfast at a local diner, we drove 45 minutes to the mountain. The first thing I saw when we arrived was a sign that said, avalanche danger. Avalanches? Nobody told me about avalanches. Neither Kevin nor Jack reacted to the sign. It was as if it was as common as a slow, children playing sign. We parked the car, unpacked, and prepared for our climb. And then we headed over to the mountain.
People slide off the mountain. One thing you have to learn before we start in case one of you guys fall and start to slide is how to stop the fall, Kevin said as he showed us how to stop ourselves with an ice axe on a small hill before the climb.
So, to recap, in climbing Mount Washington, you can break a leg, walk off the mountain, the winds have blown at almost 300 miles per hour, visibility is less than zero, you need to use an ice axe to stop yous from sliding off the mountain, and yous could freeze to death. Other than that, there was really nothing to it. As I watched the demonstration, I thought to myself, yep, Sarah might have been right. I tend to jump into things without thinking about the consequences. Aim, fire, ready? I guess I started to get a little case of cold feet, even in my stiff mountain boots. Hey, Kevin, I said privately, I heard something about tour guides. Do we have one?
No,
he said.
Any reason? It's a fucking mountain, Jesse, he said. It goes up.
But
you live with a Navy SEAL, he said, and if we get lost, we'll just use the force.
Well, at least we have Jack, I said. He's kind of like a tour guide.
No, Jesse. Jack's a human ambulance. That's it.
Even though it was 0 degrees when we were about to climb, I wore only a long-sleeve Patagonia Performance t-shirt to start. The cardinal rule of hiking in the winter is no cotton. When cotton gets wet, it ceases to insulate the body because all of the air pockets in the fabric fill up with water. When you're lugging a 57-pound pack, even in 0 degrees, you begin to sweat quickly. And sweat is the enemy because if you sweat and cool off, you'll get hypothermia. At least that's what Kevin and Jack told me, and I believe them. They said one of the keys to surviving the outdoors and the cold elements is to control your body temp as best you can. And as you go higher in altitude, you begin to layer up. A mile up, you put on a long sleeve shirt. Above the tree line, a light jacket. And at the top, your Arctic jacket. It was go time. We started to climb. Higher and higher. Our first goal was to get to where we would camp for the night, which was about 2.2 miles up the mountain, and we arrived there a few hours later. The camp area consisted of a series of wood platforms with roofs. No walls. They were fully exposed. Luckily, we found one that had snowbank walls creating an igloo effect to block the wind. The plan now was to bunk down for the night and get an early jump on the climb the next day. The view of the other mountains was incredible, but it was still too snowy to see the top of our peak. And it was only 2 o'clock p.m., so we had 19 hours before our next go time. 19 hours. 19 Atlanta hours go by like a flash. 19 New York City hours feel like 19 minutes. But here at base camp, it seemed like a very long time. Immediately, Jack pulled out a small propane tank and started a fire. Later, he made a dinner for us of oatmeal and pasta. The sun went down at 4:30 p.m. and we ate by flashlight. At about 7 o'clock, we went out for a hike. There was nothing to see in the pitch darkness, but it was good to have something to do. We bumped into another hiker while we were out, the only other human we saw in hours. The guy had a Grizzly Adams beard and wintry, weathered skin, and he was eating an apple with no gloves. No gloves! I had 2 pairs of gloves on and glove warmers, and my fingertips were still frozen. It looked like this guy lived on top of the mountain and hadn't been anywhere else in his life, ever. Adam asked him if he'd ever summited the mountain. Adam, you fucking moron, I thought. Of course this guy has summited the mountain. That's like asking Aquaman if he swims.
37 times, the guy said.
By the time we got back to camp, the conversation was played out, and so with no cell phone service, radio, internet connection, there was nothing to do. There were absolutely no distractions. I started to get tired. It was either the thin air or clomping around in the boots that did me in. We all zipped into our sleeping bags. Kevin boiled water to put it in our water bottles and instructed us to put them in our sleeping bags to warm them up. It worked. I felt like a frozen burrito in the microwave. I looked at my phone. It was 8:03 p.m. I could feel and see my breath, in and out, in and out, in and out. I kept watching and feeling my breath. I stayed like that for what seemed like hours, and then I closed my eyes again and just focused on the warmth inside my sleeping bag. I remained still, just passing the hours in my frigid surroundings. There was no sensation of time, and when I finally opened my eyes, I thought it was a day later. I looked at my watch. It was 8:25 p.m. Only 22 minutes had passed? That was impossible. 22 minutes? A thought came to me, the first of several that would lead me to a monastery. This one was as clear as the mountain air, and it was delivered in a voice that was like a whisper in my ear. My relationship with time is out of balance. When I'm in my routine, time flies. When I'm not in my routine, time slows. It was a feeling I wanted to bottle up and save. At 6:35 a.m., I was up and anxious to start. It was cold as fuck. I threw on my jacket, slipped on my concrete boots, and walked 10 yards away from camp in the thick powder to urinate. When I got back, I ducked right into my sleeping bag to get warm. Everyone was already up and chatting. We made a safety plan. If we didn't get to the summit by 1 o'clock p.m., then no matter where we were on the mountain, we had to turn around. After that time, it would get too dark and too dangerous. We all agreed. It was a pact. We started to get ready to roll. On went my boots, thermals, and backpack. Jack had told me yesterday to hold my breath when I put on my goggles or they'd fog up, and it'd be 100% impossible to defog them. I took a huge breath like a sixth grader jumping into the deep end of the pool, and then I quickly put my goggles on to test the method. It worked. It was time to climb. 9:15 a.m. We came upon a tree on which was tacked an avalanche report. It instructed us to go back about a mile to take a different approach. Great. Jack and Kevin seemed to take this information in stride. But I had an image in my head of body surfing a massive wave of snow. Unsuccessfully. We did an about-face and headed back from where we'd come. 10:30 a.m. Eventually, we started to hike higher. Most of the snow had been blown off the mountain, but there were spots where it was up to the top of our boots, and walking through it was like walking in a wading pool filled with glue, only up at a 45-degree angle. The climb was so steep, we had to hold on to trees or roots, otherwise we'd fall. Now I understood how people slid off the mountain. The new plan called for us to reach the summit by 1:30 p.m., which would still give us enough time to get back down the mountain before sunset. But we agreed that 1:30 was the absolute new cutoff time.
"We'll make good time until we get above the tree line," Kevin said. "Then it'll get hairy."
"What do you mean, hairy?"
"You'll find out," he said.
Noon. We took a trail called Lion's Head, the winter route. This is where things get real, according to Jack. From there, we'd either try to make it to the summit or turn around to go home. And that's when I learned there's a huge difference between above the tree line and below the tree line. We were no longer protected from the elements. When we reached the top of Lion's Head, the gust had to be at least 40 miles an hour. It was like someone turned a snow machine on in my face. The wind blew a fine powder, making it hard to see my hand in front of me. Instantly, it was like we were in a giant snow globe that had just been picked up by a rambunctious 8-year-old. The snow was shaking at us from all angles.
"Go to your left!"
Kevin shouted. "What?"
"Go to your left!"
"What?"
"Go to your left!"
I moved to my left. At this point, to communicate, everyone had to yell. And still, we could barely hear each other with the wind and snow whipping around. Kevin pulled out orange sticks from his pack to mark our trail so we'd know our way back as we inched higher. But the problem was, I couldn't see the sticks a few steps after I passed one. I looked back, and it was like they'd instantly disappear.
"We need 4 hours of daylight to get back to base camp," Jack yelled over a gust of wind. "At the rate we're going, we'll never reach the summit in time."
We all sort of stopped and huddled, and the snowy wind kept whipping around. It was decision time. Kevin looked slightly concerned. "Guys," I yelled, "I got 4 kids and I'm friggin' scared. We made a pact." No one debated that. Plus, these were those important instincts I mentioned earlier that we all need to rely on.
"We're only a quarter mile from the top,"
Kevin said, almost like he was trying to convince himself to keep going. But we collectively decided to turn around. It was only when we returned safely on the flat earth that the disappointment set in. Still, the whole experience had left me with a sense of exhilaration. When you climb something so high and so dangerous, you feel like you're the first person on the planet to do it. But it was more than just the challenge. On the mountain, I could actually feel time, sense it. I could touch it and hold it. The higher we climbed, the more real it felt. People often tell me time is precious, but they don't really know. They only think it's precious when it's gone or it's slipping by. On the mountain, time felt precious because of the way you experienced it. There were moments, not minutes. 4 days later. I was sitting in bed with Sarah and still not over the disappointment of not completing the challenge of the mountain. My email was filled with friends reminding me that I didn't make it.
"Must be tough to get that far and not finish," one of them read.
"I failed," I said to my wife, putting down my phone. "No, you didn't," she said. "That's crazy talk." "No, I failed. I took my friends and we didn't make it. I need to go back." "That's a wonderful idea, sweetie. Plan a weekend next winter, get a tour guide, you numbskull, and properly break in your boots." Next winter? I said. Next winter? No way. I'm going back on Saturday.
Saturday?
Yes, this Saturday. I have no guarantee that I'll be here to do it next winter. I have no idea if I'll be healthy enough next winter. I'm going back this weekend. The mountain reminded me how important time is. Putting things off can often lead to regret. Acting now, even if the timing isn't perfect or everything isn't figured out, has always been the way I operate. It's often the difference between failure and incredible accomplishment. You can't outsmart time, but you can learn to maximize it. I was going back on Saturday. That Saturday. After a lot of processing by Sarah, I got a hall pass, but this time it was for only 24 hours. There was no overnight. The plan was to climb up to the summit, get back down before dark, and then fly home. We estimated the climb would be about 10 hours round trip. Kevin reviewed the safety procedures and we started on our journey up the mountain around 7 a.m. As we climbed higher and higher and higher, it felt like we were walking on the moon. There was a freezing mix of pelting snow, fierce wind, and icy ice, and it was layered with a healthy amount of fear. And then, 5 hours later, the same crew from last week, plus the local guide, stood on top of the summit of Mount Washington, hugging in celebration. There are 7 billion people on the face of the earth, and yet, it felt like we were the sole survivors, the last of the human race, alone and frozen in time. As we made our way down the mountain, I was reminded of a quote I love by Haruki Murakami. And once the storm is over, you won't remember how you made it through, how you managed to survive. You won't even be sure, in fact, whether the storm is really over. But one thing is certain. When you come out of the storm, you won't be the same person who walked in. In that frigid isolation, another of those guiding thoughts came to me. I needed this feeling permanently in my life, or at least a way to access it when needed. And I didn't know it at the time, but it was the beginning of my journey to the monastery. Here I come. Everything changes. Nothing remains without change. Buddha. March 2017, the night before the monastery. I'm not a selfie guy, not even close. Don't get me wrong. I'm as vain as the next guy. But how many times can you look at your own picture? I just don't get it. But here I was, standing in my living room, staring at my hair, about to take a selfie. I checked myself in the mirror and pulled my hair back as tight as it could go to see what it was going to look like. I wasn't so sure about this. I turned my head to the left and got a profile view, and it wasn't much better. I grabbed my phone and flipped the camera so I could get a nice tight shot of just my head. Snap, snap. And then I took my finger and tried to block out where my hair was, but it still wasn't doing the trick. I needed something else. I went to the app store and searched for Make Me Bald. I scrolled through the numerous options and decided on Baldify. Go bald. 99 cents. Secretly, I was hoping I'd look so ridiculous I wouldn't do it, but the clock was ticking. Jessica, my wife's hairstylist, was on her way over. She comes to our house to cut Sarah's hair about once a month, and I usually piggyback a trim off it. I called her earlier in the day for an emergency appointment. Finally, the app downloaded. Just as I clicked it open, I heard the front door open and shut. "Hello, honey, I'm home," Sarah said, and so is Jessica. While my wife kissed our 4 lovely children hello, Jessica transformed our bathroom into a pop-up salon. I put the phone in my pocket and sat down in the chair. I realized I just wasted 99 cents on the app. Jessica wrapped me in a black smock, and I looked at myself in the mirror. I have curly blonde hair that's been a bit unruly. It's been my trademark since I was a kid. It's like my version of Madonna's beauty mark, Bonzi's jacket, or Nelly's Band-Aid back in the day. It's my thing. I've always worn a headband or ski hat with my blonde locks leaking out. But though the decision was a drastic one, I've made up my mind. I was going bald. Sarah, I yelled, it's go time. I needed my wife to watch. This was an emotional moment, and I wanted her support. Sarah walked into the bathroom with a pretzel rod hanging from her mouth like a cigar. Tell me this again, sweetie, she said. Why in the world are you shaving your head? Because it's required. Required? I'm going to a monastery, silly. This is ridiculous. Ridiculous. Don't you think you're being a bit extreme, Jesse? Extreme? Not at all. I have to do it. No hair is basic monastery 101. Going with a mop of hair would be disrespectful. Sarah snapped off a bite of her pretzel. I can't believe I signed up for this, she said. I really can't believe I signed up for this. There must have been an echo in the room. But it's a known fact in our marriage that when Sarah tells me about something that bothers her, she says it twice. Sort of like Jimmy Two Times in Goodfellas, except Sarah isn't an Italian mobster. She's my primary. I know, honey, I said, and that's why I love you. Fire it up, Jessica, she said with another chomp of her pretzel. Shave it all off. Jessica plugged in the razor and flipped it on. It sounded like a swarm of angry bees. I closed my eyes when the electric buzz went next to my ear. I felt the cold metal teeth touch the skin at the base of my skull. Jessica slowly slid the electric razor up to the top of my head. I looked down to see my blonde locks bounce off the smock and hit the ground in a little hairy pile. I closed my eyes again, and when I opened them, I looked more like Walter White from Breaking Bad than a monk in the movie Gandhi. Sarah and I spent the next hour staring at my shaved head. Not really, but I kept taking a peek in the mirror while we got the kids ready for bed. We have four. All of them are under the age of 7, so organization and efficiency are keys to success. We devised a kind of human car wash. Sarah takes our 2 3-year-old boys in the bath and helps them. She washes, they splash. Then she passes them over to the tub to me, where I towel dry them, apply their pull-ups, and put on their PJs. Meanwhile, my oldest son, Laser, age 7, gets in the tub next. The grand finale is our daughter, who's 15 months old, and the whole process takes about 20 minutes. And then from there, it's story time with Mommy and tuck-in time with Daddy. The next morning, I was in full-on hustle mode, completing the final preparations for my trip. I'd written a list of all the scheduled activities for the kids to give to Sarah, even though it's on her calendar, and put together to-dos and where are they's for her. Get banana chips for the kids, lock the doors at night where the soccer cleats are. I was transcribing them onto post-its and sticking them to the refrigerator door when I looked over and noticed Sarah peering into my open suitcase. It was like she was eyeing a penny she dropped into a wishing well. My bag contained fruits and veggies, lots and lots of fruits and veggies. I had dozens of bananas, 26 apples, 3 bags of organic carrots, 30 oranges, a box of spinach, and 3 sticks of celery for garnish. I packed it myself. For 27 years, I've only eaten fruit until noon. The fast explanation is that most digestion requires a tremendous amount of energy. That's why if you eat a big meal, you often get tired afterward. So if we streamline our digestion and use less energy during the process, it frees up more energy for everything else. Fruit, if eaten correctly, digests super efficiently. So I wanted to ensure I'd have enough of a supply at the monastery. Who knows what monks eat? In fact, I know nothing about monks outside of what I've seen in the movies. And my only recollection is that they're small, spiritual, quiet, and oozing with wisdom. You never see a monk eat in a movie. Weird, right? I'm assuming there are clothes in here somewhere, Sarah half said, half asked. Yes, honey. Did you pack a robe, Mahatma?
Ha. I actually thought about it, but they'll probably give me one, right? I was kidding. I'm not. I'm going full Dalai Lama. Robe, sandals, the whole bit. Sandals? Absolutely. Isn't this place in Vermont? Upstate New York. It's the middle of March, Jesse. They probably...